We've been more or less abandoned by our corporate and governmental elite, and sadly, largely by our academic elite, certainly by the media, entertainment, mainstream elite. There are one or two cracks in those walls, fortunately. CNN was kind enough to put me on recently, and there have been one or two other examples, but it's certainly not enough. There are now these examples of people coming together, and the ones that we know most about, not surprisingly, are the ones that have come to us and are organizing with us, and we're helping them organize, and they're helping us organize, because we're developing this as we go. Many of them, it came about that the first of them in Benicia Vallejo in California, a place that fought off an LNG terminal in 2003, they came together and decided to take this really seriously, and they called themselves an outpost. And by and large, it's quite a nice term. It does have a certain military connotation, but it doesn't always have to have that. It does suggest that one is a bit out on the edge, but I think we are, unfortunately. But the idea of the post-carbon outpost is to do what we call post-carbon experiments. And these experiments focus on relocalizing money, energy, and food, which I've talked about, but also this means relocalizing governance, culture, in some cases water, in some cases sewage as well. Groups are coming together now and meeting and talking about these ideas seriously. There are some people in the north, including in Alaska, and there's people in Toronto, and I hope there will be some people in Vancouver who want to get serious about this, and indeed anywhere else, anywhere in the English-speaking world and anywhere in the non-English-speaking world. I do hope that we're going to be able to reach out into Europe and also into poorer parts of the world who I think are going to be sorely affected by this. So this is the inspiring part. People are coming together as outposts. If you're interested, you can find out much more about this at postcarbon.org. You can also find out more about the idea of relocalizing in my book, High Noon for Natural Gas, also available through postcarbon.org. And I should say this is almost entirely a volunteer-run organization, both Global Public Media and Post Carbon Institute. Just recently, in the last few months, we've put up an online bookstore, and we've been selling both my book and books like Richard Heinberg's Power Down and The Part Is Over. Richard Heinberg's books I strongly recommend, and several other books which talk about the energy crisis. And also, mentioning rather belatedly here, I wish I'd mentioned it right at the beginning, but the wonderful film The End of Suburbia, inspired by an interview I did with James Howard Kunstler, which is available on Global Public Media. It's just down for maintenance. That interview is just off for a couple of days, but it should be back up within 2 days. That's a very interesting interview, and Jim Kunstler basically concentrates on the problems of suburbia. That was created into this extraordinary film. It's available on DVD from postcarbon.org, where we're the largest seller of that film. It was made by two Canadians, Barry Silverthorne and Greg Green, over there in Toronto. And End of Suburbia just can't be recommended highly enough. It's a marvelous film. It forms a fantastic introduction to the peak oil issue, and there's mention of natural gas too. And it's actually funny. It's charming. It's hard-hitting. It's beautifully made. It's just a fantastic introduction. And that's another thing that I can say is inspiring. People have shown this film. We help people to organize it if they want. Help them with the questions to ask. And many people have seen this film and decided to come together and then want to go on from that at a community level and again form outposts, form and try to do post-carbon experiments. And also, in the next few days, for those that want to be outpost coordinators, we will be producing the post-carbon outpost guide. Been somewhere like a year in the writing. We will be getting a draft out electronically as soon as this coming week, and we're also very pleased that New Society, who've been wanting to publish something on relocalization and outposts ever since they heard about them months ago, New Society will be publishing the outpost guide sometime in the fall, in the autumn of 2005, and we're extremely pleased about that too. So there will be a book available in draft form very soon, and it will be out in full published book form later on in 2005. So these are some points to be inspired by. Please don't give up. Please don't be paralyzed like certain animals in the headlights of some wretched car. There is no time to panic. We don't have the luxury of panicking. We've got to roll up our sleeves and get practical and start doing some of the things I suggested. Please do contact us at postcarbon.org. Please go and look at the interviews at globalpublicmedia.com and do, by all means, buy my book, High Noon for Natural Gas. And I hope this will bring people into contact with one another. This is one of the things about relocalization. Start talking to one another, meeting with one another, becoming local again. We're a social primate. We don't like being on our own. It makes us miserable and isolated and depressed. We need to be doing shared tasks. That's what creates community. Community means sharing with, and one of the most important things that we humans do is share tasks. And let's make them good tasks. I mean, the task of military domination is a shared task, and my God, we do with dreadful ferocity and efficaciousness. But why can't we do some other tasks once again locally, without that ferocity, but with good intentions this time? And I think that's what we need to do. We need to get together with good intentions, talk to one another, integrate our efforts, do them with coherence, and then there may be some way forward. It's not a very happy picture at the moment. There are more than about 24 examples of societies and civilizations collapsing because they didn't address their fate properly. There are some smaller examples of people realizing what's going on and turning around and doing something about it. So it's not a hopeless situation. There are moments of inspiration. And if some of us, not all of us are going to do this, but if some of us in pockets can get together and talk to one another and plan, then I think that's where the hope lies.
Julian Darley, author of High Noon for Natural Gas and founder of the Post Carbon Institute, on the web at postcarbon.org. He was speaking with Matt Soltis of Environment Radio in Guelph, Ontario. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Free Radio Asheville, or WGDR Plainfield. A few local events in the Finger Lakes relevant to democracy and sustainability. The next meeting of Back to Democracy will be tomorrow, Monday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Rongovian Embassy on Main Street in Teberg. A documentary film, The Future of Food, about genetically modified foods and alternatives will be screened. The event is free and all are welcome. Coming up on Tuesday, physicist, ecologist, activist, and author Vandana Shiva will speak at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Shiva will present Earth Democracy, Justice, Sustainability, and Peace at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 26th in the Geneva Room of the Warren Hunting Smith Library on Pulteney Street in Geneva on the Hobart campus. The presentation will be free and open to the public, and WEOS will broadcast this event live on 89.7 and on Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1 in Ithaca. That's Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. And the Finger Lakes Land Trust will be holding a work party at the High Vista Preserve next Saturday, April 30th at 10 a.m. to spread wood chips on the trail, clear deadfalls, and finish cleanup of an old house foundation. The preserve is on the east side of Skinny Atlas Lake, just off Route 41. Call area code 607-275-9487. Or go on the web to fllt.org for information and directions. These events will be listed on the Unwelcome Guests website, unwelcomeguests.org, in the show archive under show number 251. Coming up, the new agrarianism, after this song, which I'd like to dedicate to my home, Schuyler County, New York.
There are places where there are hills. There They're not just called hills, they're really hills. And there are places where there are forests, not like 12 pines, but really forests. There are places where the birds sing, you can hear the eagle call. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places where there are rivers, not surrounded by concrete, but living rivers with fish in them and frogs and little tadpoles, with ducks and deer drinking by the sinkholes. There are places far away, the trees turn colors in the fall. No, they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places you can see the sky, not neon signs and billboards, but just the sky. There are places with dirt on the ground, without miles of asphalt, not a car around, where on and in the soil good little critters crawl. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places like that, and things don't have to be like this. I mean, not just cosmetic changes, things really don't have to be like this. There are places where people know their neighborhood, where people live there, and they think that life is good. There are places like that, somewhere on this spinning ball. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall. There are places that I know I've gotta find, otherwise I will undoubtedly lose my mind. Otherwise I'll end up just like you, on Ritalin or Prozac or whatever things you do. I'm going where the water is blue and the trees are oh so tall. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond the mall.
Somewhere Beyond the Mall by David Rovix. Last fall, I attended the first national conference on peak oil and community solutions in Ohio, and I've played many of the presentations from it over the past 6 months. We'll conclude the program this week with another talk from that conference that takes a look at what Professor Charles Stevens calls the new agrarian movement, which strives to address not only issues of sustainability, but connects to a vision of America that never was, but whose time may have come by necessity. Charles Stevens is an anthropologist on the faculty of Miami University in Ohio. He has extensively studied indigenous agricultural methods in Polynesia. Professor Charles Stevens.
At lunch, we were talking variously about what we were supposed to do about marauding bands of folks with shotguns stealing our organic tomatoes that we grew in our intentional communities. And it was a disturbing conversation in many ways, but we finally decided that the answer, if there are any answers, are in community and local, focusing on local answers. I also kind of came out of our conversation at lunch with a kind of a dissatisfaction with what I'm going to say today, because people are looking for specific answers. And I think what we're doing today in the next couple of days is giving basic ideas out of which we can develop specific and appropriate answers to specific local, ecological, environmental, and social issues. So I don't have any specific, I'm not going to come here and tell you exactly what kind of rotation cycle you need to put into your organic farm. There is knowledge about how to do that, but mostly we're going to have to work it out to a large extent. That's perhaps the bad news. The good news is human beings have been doing agriculture for something like 10,000 years, variously successfully, in some places extraordinarily successfully. Wet rice agriculture in China, 5,000 years, very sustainable system, very highly productive system. I studied with people in the South Pacific on an island that was 99 square miles in size. That was a big island for them. They've been doing agriculture on this island for 2,700 years. And until 1960s, they didn't mess it up. That's a long time to do good, solid agriculture. Now, not everything about Polynesian societies is touchy-feely and happy, but they certainly knew how to do good agriculture in a tropical environment. Two of my heroes here, Thomas Jefferson Wendell Berry. Guys who had pretty neat ideas. Ideas that we still kick around every day. Pursuit of happiness. All men being created equal. These are not easy ideas. And they're not going to become easy. But one of the problems we have with these icons, both of these men are icons, is that we think they're too romantic. And I think that that's not fair. They're philosophers they're really philosophers. Philosophers tell us about ideas. They give us concepts. Whether or not we can successfully put those concepts into action is another issue, but that's not their job. Right? Their job are to give us philosophies, ideas out of which we can work. And so I don't think it's fair to say that Wendell Berry is too romantic. I don't happen to think he is. I think that in many ways he tells us about good ways to live life, good ways to be in touch with the earth, good ways to grow our food, good ways to be independent, lots of good things. And so I don't think my concern, and I'm going to start off here talking about whether or not this is a romantic idea, this idea of agrarianism, and also how we can make it a pragmatic reality. Jefferson got his idea out of Whig romanticism, this idea, this focus on history of a time in history that actually never existed, about smallholders on the landscape, growing crops in more or less egalitarian communities. And everybody knew then that this Whig romanticism depicted a world that never existed. But this was fundamental in Jefferson's idea of the world, and I have a quote for him later that points this out. But he had this idea of rural communities forming a philosophical basis for sustainable, productive local agriculture that was not petroleum dependent. And I think that we can draw out of his agrarianism a vision that works in many ways for us. If what we can do is take this agrarian vision and add to it what have become increasingly scientific justification of agroecological principles, scientific justification for indigenous agriculture that's been going on for a long time. Why scientific? Because, in our culture, we won't pay attention to anything unless it's scientifically justified. So the fact that people have been doing good indigenous agriculture for a long period of time doesn't work for us, for a lot of xenophobic and other, imperialistic ideas that permeate our culture. So we need a scientist to tell us, this little brown guy over here really does know what he's doing when he's planting yams. And then we go, well, okay, it's not really the little guy over here. It's the scientist that's telling us how to do it. So, and I think that people, the agroecologists like Miguel Altieri and Stephen Gleisman and a lot of other people, we'll tell you right up front, the reason we're doing this agroecological research is to come up with the scientific legitimation of processes that have already been going on for a long time. And I think that that's our cultural deficit, right? That's something we need to fix within ourselves. And I think that, so if we have to legitimate it through science and trial and error, then let's do that. Anthropology also offers us an awful lot of examples of highly sustainable, highly productive in agricultural systems from whom we can learn. And so I think that what we can do with this agrarian philosophy that may appear to be romantic is to realize that we have now good scientific as well as anthropological information that will tell us that we can turn that vision into a reasonable, cooperative, here's a bad word, communitarian way of getting to the world post-carbon. And I think that we have lots of options, and I'm tired of being pessimistic. Even after November 2nd, I'm tired of being pessimistic. I am tired of acquiescing to power. I'll let that go. We have a lot of options. I think we need to take them. Let them do their trip. We can do ours at the local level. Jefferson saw this. He saw America as a refuge for original Saxon values. And he thought fundamentally that there was something good about being engaged in the land, about getting your hands dirty, about having your lifestyle programmed, that's the bad word, structured by something outside of yourself, in this case, nature. Realizing even before it happened that the idea of 8 to 5 is a dehumanizing principle. So maybe this is highly romanticized, but I think that, and Wendell Berry talks about this, David Klein talks about this, Gene Logsdon talks about this, about the benefits that people get when they start becoming in part of a system that is larger than themselves. Right? And I'm not talking about the petroleum system and the corporate system. I'm talking about geological systems that have nothing to do with us. They've existed well before us, will exist long after us. Human beings are not exempt from extinction events. That's the bad part we're talking about here today and this weekend. We need to work on what we have control over. So it is highly romanticized, but he also thought that land stewardship brought with it a certain moral strength of character. And he envisioned, as we all know, an America based on small agrarian farmers, because he felt that when you're in that place, there's a moral character that develops by from working the land. And so he also thought that there was a correlation between closeness to nature and closeness to God. And we see that again in a resurgence conservation, what's the word I'm looking for? Congregations. Right, so we have an ethos in Christianity and other religions that tie us back to closeness to nature, gives us a closeness to God. Now, for Jefferson, he tied it into his political wisdom as well. And so, this is a wonderful quote, of course. And I don't know how comfortable I feel with this particular quote from Jefferson, but he says, "The tree of liberty is refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It's its natural manure." Tom Jefferson thought that revolutions were good things once in a while. A few of us may have shotguns. They've got Apache attack helicopter. So how far we want to go with this is something we can talk about some other time. Now, in actuality, agricultural stewardship as part of agrarianism didn't actually happen until the 1820s, when the devastation that was brought by the introduction of agriculture, particularly here to Ohio and other places, made people realize very quickly that they had to adopt an agrarian type of agriculture. The colonization of Ohio, those of you who are historians know that it was a thoroughly devastating event. You know, people talked about sycamore trees that were big enough to ride your horse into and camp out overnight. And what did they do with those sycamore trees? They cut them down. The last native deer in Butler County was shot in 1890, not too far from my house. They had to be reintroduced. So this was a devastating settlement. And they recognized this in the 1820s. There's a great book by Stephen Stoll called Larding the Lean Earth that talks about this agrarian vision in the 1820s that was resurrected because of practical necessity to do so. And I think to some extent, that's where we are. Again, Aldo Leopold, 1949, was probably the founder of kind of this modern vision of agrarianism. And here's this great quote: "A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community." A realization here, without going into evolutionary theory, but a realization here that human beings are also part of this biotic community. And to the extent that we destroy that community, we're destroying also the life support system that we as animals are also dependent upon. And this is another quote then from Aldo Leopold: "The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively the land." And Wendell Berry brings this back up again, that we should include in our community, as we build these community alternatives to post-oil, that we include in it animal life, plant life, the ecosystem, as members of the community, and in a sense give them a vote. In what it is that we're doing. In other words, we're not the only animals involved in this process. Now, Wendell Berry, it seems to me, purposely tries to get away from a romanticized vision of the farmer. And so he says in this quote here that the idea that farmers are the salt of the earth, the pure independent person, the child of nature, is as wrong as the image that a farmer is some sort of bumbling idiot who, had, if he had any sense, would be doing something else. An awful lot of farmers, particularly all the farmers I've ever met, are doing farming because they love to do farming. That's the first thing, most of them. The second thing is, you can't be stupid and be successful at farming. Farming, even mechanized farming, is incredibly complicated. The knowledge system that indigenous farmers had is immense, generations long. I can't remember the fellow's name right now, it may come to me, but there's a fellow who did work amongst dry rice farmers in Africa who would count within a particular region 60 varieties of a single species of dry land rice. Farmers would have 15 varieties of the same species of dry land rice, and they would know what part of their property, what soil type to plant specific varieties of rice, which varieties of rice would return in a dry season, which varieties of rice would return in a wet season. It takes an awful lot of knowledge to do this. The good news of that kind of system is if you have a drought, your yields will go down, but you will not starve to death. If you're a soybean corn rotation farmer in Ohio and you were in the wrong rotation 3 years ago, you lost the farm, right? Because of the consequences, the risk of monocropping. So out of indigenous farmers, we get this image of farming that is highly biodiverse and therefore very stable, right? There are other problems with it. I don't want to be too romanticist about it. But that biodiversity provides us with some stability. So here's this great article, Conserving Community. You can type it into Google. You can get a copy of it on the web. And I just extracted some of the things that Wendell Berry said in this. And he said some very fundamental questions. I will later on have a slide that says these are radical ideas. They're only radical ideas because to the extent to which we've internalized, in some sense, unquestioningly, the ideological backdrop of our economic system. Right? That's why these ideas seem radical now, is because he's proposing that we don't look about maximizing utility at the individual level. It's not about what Wendell Berry is talking about. What I'm talking about is not whether or not I, as an individual, can maximize my capital. It's whether or not my community and myself as a member of it can maximize our common wealth. And I as an individual benefit from that. I'm not talking about American individualism. I'm talking about the individuality that involves people in a community. Always include local nature, the land, the water, and the air as members of the community. I already talked about that. Always ask of any proposed change or innovation, what will this do, not so much to me, but to the community? What will this do to the community? How will this affect the commonwealth of the community? Always ask how local needs must be supplied from local sources, including the mutual help of neighbors. I had the pleasure of going to Italy this last summer, having a great dinner with some colleagues down there who work in agroecology, and we got talking about the Iraqi war and Americans. And they basically said that they feel sorry for us because we lack contact with our community. They see us as a bunch of atomized individuals. I think that's overstating it. I don't think we are entirely a bunch of atomized individuals. But what they have in Italy, if you've ever been there, is in the afternoon, everybody goes to the piazza and hangs around with each other and talks to one another and buys books and eats ice cream. When these people close their shutters at night, they say goodnight to their neighbors across the street, right? And so they have this communitarian ethos, I think, that we're lacking here. We must strive to produce as much of our own energy as possible, always supply local needs first, which is exactly the opposite of what's going on in industrial agriculture now, which is about buying into a global market, producing for a local market. Wendell Berry is suggesting here that we supply our local needs first. The idea that we ship in lettuce from California makes a lot of economic sense because there's truckers making their living doing that. But it is ecologically nonsense. We can grow all the lettuce we need in Ohio. We can't grow oranges or kiwi fruit, but we can certainly do carrots, lettuce, tomatoes, and lots of other things. We have to invest in ourselves as community rather than investing in General Electric. We cannot externalize the cost of keeping our community clean. In other words, keeping our community clean by putting our crap someplace else isn't part of the solution, right? That's externalization of cost. We can't do that. And I like the bottom one, too, because this is an important part of being a community, and that is we separate generations, right? Old people are stupid. We put them off into nursing homes. Old people are wealths of information that will disappear when they die. And so intergenerational farm, I'm blessed to be able to stay at one and visit very shortly with some people who are holding me for letting me stay there for this conference. Here's three generations of people on this farm where I saw a daughter quite literally learning from her grandfather about how to take care of goats and chickens and stuff. That's the kind of communitarianism and family structure I think that we've lost in the United States to some extent, and Wendell Berry and others are suggesting we revitalize. And here's this quote that he says, these ideas are radical only because national and global economies have been formed in perfect disregard for and disdain of community and ecological issues. You know, the market system will tell us that resource depletion does not exist because the market itself holds the automatic augmentating mechanism that will reduce scarcity to a non-issue, right? Because knowing actors, right, economic actors seeing the price of a resource go up because of scarcity will seek an alternative. right? Or they'll seek a new way of extracting it, or they'll seek a new way of processing it. And there is some truth in that. But then we get Julian Simon's idea that copper is a state of mind. And then he tells us that, optic fiber was the very enactment of this market ideology that meant copper for wiring is no longer useful because we developed optic fiber. He doesn't tell us, of course, that optic fiber was not developed because of copper scarcity. It was developed for completely other reasons. So the market, the market mentality is one of the things we have to get away from, it seems to me. There are some truths in it. There are some truths about effective efficiency of economics. But it's not that we can't idealize economic alternatives for everything. But I'm not suggesting in my talk that we disregard markets altogether. What I'm suggesting is that we don't absolutize, if that's a word, market mentalities. The market cannot do everything. So I'm suggesting that Berry and Thomas Jefferson and others, Wes Jackson, David Klein, who does the Farming magazine, which if you don't get, you should get, are presenting a philosophical basis for an alternative vision that I think if we add scientific information and anthropological information, is actually the basis for one answer to peak oil. So then that brings up the idea of sustainability. And I see sustainability having these four components. Usually people talk about three components, but I think if we want to get from what is now an unsustainable world to a more sustainable world, we have to change the way we think. And that's why I have added this, and other people as well, have added this ideological component. We have to think differently about the world. So the idea of sustainability includes environmental components. That's the one most of us are familiar with. It also involves economic components. You can't be running in the red all the time. Whether you're running into ecological red or you're running into the financial red, it's not going to work. You're going to have to come up with some way of staying in business as well as staying within the confines of an environmental system. There are social components. Social inequality is unsustainable. It is destabilizing. I am not suggesting, I'm an anthropologist by training, I do not know of any purely egalitarian societies outside of hunter and gatherer societies. And that will not work. It's with 6.4 billion people. The red squirrel population wouldn't make it past an afternoon. Then what are we going to do? But relative egalitarian distribution of food resources is something that is attainable globally, I think. And particularly, it's completely attainable at the local level. And ideological components, we have to start thinking about ourselves. Get rid of this human hubris. We are not the only species on the planet. Indeed, we cannot survive without the other species. And most importantly for Americans, and I hate to trash on us too much because we are good people in many ways, it's not all about us. Right? I mean, as I tell my daughter, it's not about you. Right? It's not about you. I also tell my daughter, you can make it easy or you can make it hard. Right? But what's going to happen is going to happen. You decide how you want to go about it. And I think that's where we are in this conference. We can go easy, which I think all of us would like to do. Or we can go hard, but, peak oil's coming, whether we like it or not. So there's all kinds of ideological ways of rethinking the world to get to a sustainable relationship, which I think is a relationship between dynamic economic system, large and larger dynamic but more slowly changing ecological system. Human individuals can flourish. Look, part of the idea of sustainability is that individuals are happy with what they're doing, that they're comfortable in their social environments, that they find some intellectual as well as spiritual meaning in what they're doing. And so individuals have to flourish in what they're doing. And look, a lot of philosophers said that, from Wendell Berry to Karl Marx. Karl Marx told us that the most important thing about human beings is their labor, what it is that they do. What human beings do is their being. That's what we are, is what we do. That's the life we lead is based on how we spend our life and what it is that we do in our life. We don't think of Karl Marx saying stuff like that, but that was very much the basis of his idea, which we accept as capitalists, is that we all want to do things we enjoy doing. And who wants to work in a drywall cubbyhole for their whole life? Some people must. I don't know who they are. The other thing is that human cultures can develop or remain stable. I've got some notes that I've managed not to look at while I've been talking. I think that what I was going to say about the stability of things is that we are also obsessed with the idea of progress as some sort of linear thing. And so part of what we're talking about is not so much indefinite progress, but a form of stability. Not all cultures want to progress indefinitely. I think that some cultures want to remain relatively stable over the long haul. And I think that there's some positive aspects of that as well. As well as infinite progress and development. which is only available, after all, with cheap energy. And fundamentally, sustainability is where the effects of human activities remain within the bounds of established ecosystemic constraints, which are, in my opinion, those ecosystemic constraints are defined outside of us. They exist substantially outside of us. There are systems over which human beings have no control. Don't tell that to an economist. But there are systems that are beyond our control. And the ecological system, to some extent, is one of those. Now, here I go getting political again. Some people can look back on the 19th and 20th century, and what you get is a very positive vision of everything's getting better for human beings, onward and ever and better all the time. Here we go. We have visions of Star Trek and these wonderful multicultural communities on starships everywhere. And you got to be rich in the first place to believe that. And that's harsh. But when I look back on the 19th and 20th century, I see, in the 20th century alone, 180 million dead people from conflict. Is there progress out of that? Yeah, there's some progress out of that. Is that a happy vision of the world? Not for me. Right? Is there another alternative? I think there must be some other alternative. Otherwise, extinction event is, it seems to me, just a matter of time. That's pretty depressing. I was going to come up here and give you guys solutions. Are there questions that I can... Can we stop and ask questions at this point while we're waiting for this to power back up? I've heard the book. The question was, he had just finished reading a book called Overshoot by Kaplan. Is that correct? Catlin.
C-A-T-T-O-N.
Yeah, that we've basically overreached environmental limits. Yeah. I don't want to get overly romantic here. There's no way to do agriculture without disrupting the ecosystem. You can't start digging up the ground and shaking out trees and replacing one group of biotic species with another and call it natural entirely. It's not. But there are scales here of what it is you want to release into the ecosystem. Preservation and rebuilding of soil fertility. A good organic farmer will tell you that organic farming done correctly will always improve the soil fertility. And I know that we can't exactly say that the backyard garden is exactly the same thing as large-scale agriculture, but anybody who's got a good backyard garden plot that they've been working on for, let's say, 5 or 10 years is a work of art. I mean, now you go out there and you pick it up and it's beautiful, it smells good, it's got critters in it, and it just gets better and better and better. And in principle, there's no reason why you can't keep doing that. Even on a larger scale, I know I'm being naive in some ways, but with rotation, application of manure, conservation of the resource, biodiversity, rotation, I already said rotation system, but there's a way of doing agriculture, I'm convinced, where the soil quality only gets better. One of the things I want to get to later on that may be a solution for the post-peak period is that instead of having 5 acres of turf grass, we might have 5 acres of productive landscapes, which means that you can't rake your leaves and put them out by the road for some giant vacuum cleaner to come by and take them away. And I'm arguing, along with people like Laura Jackson, that you can do a successful organic farm that mimics a natural habitat, that you can include things like pasturage of native species, not fescue, native species of grass, that you can use that not only for pasturage but also for cellulotic ethanol, right? You have to be careful how frequently you extract that grass from your pasture, because you want to maintain soil fertility. When you take stuff away from a pasturage or from a garden area, you're taking away the energy that you need to rebuild the soil. But there are ways of doing it carefully so that you can make alcohol, feed your animals, and have a rotation system that maintains your soil fertility. Finally, here we have equitable access to appropriate technology, which means technology and knowledge about how to do effective agriculture ought to be part of the human knowledge system. I know there's money to be made off of patents, but it seems to me that part of the system later on, post-peak, will be if you know how to grow crops really well, you ought to tell your neighbor about it. It's not about you, right? It's not about Monsanto. Agroecological knowledge, distribution of food products. Now, I put this separate. This is another example of what I think is the requirement of sustainable agriculture. And I put it separately because in the temperate climate, talking to organic farmers in Preble County and Montgomery County, they will tell you that they cannot do organic agriculture without animals. Can't do it. And why? You don't have to eat the animals if you don't want to. They need the manure. And animals do wonderful things. They turn cellulose into manure, protein, and fats. And we can't do that. All the farmers I know say we got to have animals as part of our system. In this stage, in the market they're working right now, they need them to make ends meet. They need to sell the eggs, they need to sell the meat because they don't get enough market value for their organic crop for the most part. So every farmer I've talked to says they understand the idea of the animal ethicist people, the people, you know, the PETA people. They understand what you're trying to say about humanitarian treatment of animals, but they will say, look, I can't do organic agriculture without animals. You were going to say something, David?
Well, you know, 20 tons of earthworms are livestock, you feed them organic matter, and you can definitely do organic agriculture without animals.
I think there's an issue of scale, but you know, you're right. I mean, if you do want to look at it that way, the worm becomes part of your livestock. There's an animal involved in the process some kind of way. Right, micro herds. Right. Shh, I'm thinking. I see all these words. The other thing, of course, is that in a post-peak period, animals would be required for traction. If you're going to be operating at a scale larger and you can use hand tools, you're going to have some animals for traction. And the nice thing about horses and oxen is they do something that tractors don't do. They reproduce. If they can make a tractor that would reproduce, like John Deere have some issues with that. So the agro-ecosystem concept is that the crop field is basically an ecosystem. And so instead of trying to control as many aspects of the field, you allow it to be as biodiverse as possible. In some ways, it's exactly the opposite of what industrial agriculture is trying to do. Instead of limiting biodiversity, you want to enhance it. And you know, I've got this little backdoor garden. And several years ago, I came home from school, and I went in the back, as I do, you know, immediately pop a beer, go in the garden. And what I noticed was that there were horned tomato worms on my tomatoes. And now if you've had a backdoor garden, you know that one of those puppies can take a tomato plant and render it completely dead, eat all of it in a heartbeat. It's amazing how much they can go through. Well, I had planted some buckwheat and some dill and some other flowering plants that I knew attracted parasitic wasps. And those horned tomato worms got through like half a leaf. I'm not exaggerating. And when I got home, they were dead, full of all these larvae that the parasitic worms had planted in them. It works. Now, it doesn't work completely. You're going to have some yield loss. Everybody will tell you that. But you can work with nature, and I think at a large scale, to have a highly productive agricultural system. A lot of this information comes from a book by an anthropologist who's passed away, whose name is Bob Netting, N-E-T-I-N-G, Robert McSee Netting. And the book is Smallholders, Householders. It's Stanford University Press. Now, before everybody freaks out because it's an academic press, Bob was an English major. Netting, N-E-T-T-I-N-G, Smallholders, Householders. And then : The Ecological Basis for Sustainable Agriculture, or something like that. Stanford University, you can get it on Amazon. It's even a nice buy. It's like $13. Bob was an English major, so it's really readable. It's well written. Lots of information about cross-cultural information about sustainable, ecologically viable agricultural systems. And so a lot of this I get out of Bob's books. Relatively stable production per unit of land. Contrary to popular opinion, sustainable organic agriculture is more productive per unit of land than is industrial agriculture. It is more productive per unit of input energy by far than industrial agriculture. It only lacks in units per unit of labor. And that's an artificial construct because labor has been replaced by petroleum. Don't anybody tell you that we can't do organic and non-petroleum agriculture because we can't feed enough people, it doesn't produce enough per unit of land. That's simply not true. The World Bank actually commissioned a private investigation because continuously they found that small landholders kept producing more than big landholders, and it screwed up their model. They were going, no, this can't be right. You know, economies of scale, blah, 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 can't be right. Everywhere they went, India, Thailand, Cambodia, desert southwest, everywhere they went, small landholders are more productive per unit of land than big ones. And anybody who's got a backdoor garden knows how much you can get out of a small garden. It's remarkable. And I think you can transfer the model from a small garden to a big garden. I think that you can do that. Now, look, I'm sorry. That's the thing. Obviously what's going on that's lurking behind here is labor costs are high. You know, if you want to do this kind of agriculture, you're working hard. I've also had lots of people who tell me, I love what I'm doing. You know, I get up, it's good, solid work. I'm thinking while I'm doing it. It's not drudgery at all. Am I working hard? Yeah, I'm working hard. Farming is hard work. But hard isn't bad work. It's just, you know, you're just physically working, you know. But people get huge amounts of enjoyment out of that kind of work. And the yields are high. And there are ways of calculating, it's called the land equivalent ratio. You can figure out yield returns on per unit of land. Now, if you start putting in more inputs, it says here, conversely, soil erosion, water table reduction, declining resistance of crops to pests and stresses indicate that yields will drop, even if they have not already. So a really good way of figuring out whether or not agriculture is sustainable is, if your yields stay the same, but you're putting in more input, something's wrong. Similarly, if you have to suddenly put in more labor or petroleum input, something's wrong. Energy inputs on a sustainable farm are predictable and relatively sustainable. So if that energy is coming from the farm itself, then that means you're not wasting energy getting those inputs to the farm. Now, that's a problem for some people like myself who have to go someplace to get my manure, but returns to labor and energy inputs are sufficient to provide a local livelihood for producers. Small farmers in all of America are going out of business in droves because they can't make a living at being a farmer, right? Part of that is because the bank may be very sympathetic when you can't make a payment on your $350,000 combine, but it's just business, right? And the reason that farmers are going out of business is because of the sheer cost of inputs and the machinery required for it. But here's a whole bunch of production systems. Some of them are in permanent fields, some of them are in shifting cultivation. Some of them involve human labor, some of them involve animal traction. And so here, the Tongan cassava, the fourth one down there, are actually my data. And I calculated that by this. I had a farmer putting in some cassava on a field that I measured. And I just started counting the number of hours he spent putting in this cassava. It was a third crop in a rotation. And I estimated that he was spending, and this is I think it was a liberal estimate of how hard he was working, but I estimated 400 kilocalories per hour. Is about how hard he was working. You're sweating at 400 kilocalories per hour. You're working out, right? But I said let's err on the side of caution. He got out, and I forget exactly what the numbers are, but the kilocaloric return on his investment on that partial of cassava was astronomical. So I divided it all out, and he ended up getting almost 82 kilocalories for every kilocalorie of energy he put into that. That is sustainable agriculture right there. That's what you want to see. Now, there are no other inputs on most of these systems except for labor and manure. And that shows up here where we show animal traction. And all of a sudden, your rates of return go down because the animals themselves need to be taken care of. And the manure needs to go out into the field and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, these are all of these, except we get to the bottom, which is the sad part. All of these are very efficient forms of agriculture in terms of input-output ratios until we get to industrial agriculture. And then we see this 10-to-1 ratio is a very common kind of statistic with regard to corn-soybean rotation. But when we start making meat and eggs and stuff out of it, then all of a sudden the input costs are astronomical. And this is not to get it to Kroger. This is just to grow the stuff. Right? So add to that the cellophane, because everybody knows that food really comes from Kroger. Add all this, you know, polystyrate and stuff by the time you pick it up in the store. And it's impossible to do this without petroleum. It's just quite literally, you know, from here down, you can't do it. So all that's gone. Am I right? I mean, all these systems up here can have the feasibility of remaining. All of these don't. I mean, it seems to me, unless I'm missing something. I think that part of my answer is that the smallholders are the modern variant of Jeffersonian agrarian smallholders or farmers. So we have plenty of examples in the anthropological literature of rural cultivators practicing intensive, permanent agriculture in relatively densely populated places. How that looks like from where we are now, I'll get to in a second, I think. Agrarian smallholders calculate their interest over long spans of time, so they're disinclined to accept immediate technological fixes. They're conservative people. They want, they're disinclined to default on an expectation of market return, because they calculate their times not only so much in, not only for this season, not only for next season, but for the fact that they're going to pass on their farm to their son or their daughter, right? And that they got it from their grandfather and father. And so instead of thinking about what I'm doing right now, most small farmers are thinking about, actually embody their family history, are living their heritage. You know, I can't do this to the farm for an immediate return because it's not about me, right? It's about granddad, and it's about my great-grandson that hasn't been born yet, or my great-granddaughter, right? And that changes your vision, changes the way you manage your property. The amount of accumulated knowledge, again, back to this idea of Wendell Berry that you ought to learn from your grandparents and so on and so forth, the amount of accumulated knowledge that it takes to run an efficient, ecologically sustainable farm is an immense amount of knowledge. And you don't get that disproportionately from books. You get it from somebody who's got dirt on their nails and calluses on their hands. I mean, just a few of the things that you have to keep in mind, the species of plants you're growing, the species that are involved in a natural ecosystem, what kind of soil you've got, how that soil behaves under a certain kind of tillage. Well, how that soil behaves if it rains too much, how that soil behaves if it rains too little, how the plants in those soils behave if it rains too much or too little. The amount of stuff that farmers have to keep in mind is immense, including the market conditions, because that's still part of the equation. Smallholders, permaculturalists, aren't just doing it on a horizontal scale, right? You're growing tree crops, you're growing bush crops. Now, there's a lot of systems that are tropical and some of this is more applicable to tropical systems, but I don't think it's entirely applicable at all to tropical systems. Those are just the anthropological examples that we tend to have. And so there's a huge amount of variation with regard to plant species, shading, solar cycles, all kinds of stuff that go into how it is that you can do this. Particularly community relations. Small farmers learn very, very quickly, and we have an example right here in Ohio, the Amish. There are things that small farmers can't do by themselves, like build a barn. You know, you're trying to host a whole side of 6x6s, you're not going to do it on your own, unless you're one of those Incredibles guys. You know, and so you need your community to help you build barns, to put in irrigation systems, to do all numbers of things. And so it is community-based, it is communitarian. In Tonga, where I did my work, farmers are well aware of this. They're well aware of what kind of pests they've got to deal with. They're well aware of what kind of nutrient cycles they've got going on. They know that if they put chicken manure into this system here, that the fish will eat the manure, that when they get the muck out of the bottom of it, they've got this really ripe stuff that they can put immediately on their plants without burning it and stuff. They know all these kinds. The depth of their knowledge is remarkable. And they're not sophisticated scientific folks. I remember a farmer in Tonga had a third grade Tongan education, which so he wasn't well educated, but he was doing perfect trial and error field testing. It was I asked him, how do you know about which variety of plantains you wanted to grow? He said, I took this plot over here and I made sure that nothing else had been planted there for a long time, and I planted all the varieties of plantain that I knew and I picked the ones that grew best. We got PhDs at Ohio State that are doing that. Here's this Tongan farmer who's going, trial and error, dude. There are small in size, permanently located, densely rural populated areas, highly continuously productive, serve both subsistence and market demands. And I think that that's what's really missing in the stereotypical industrial farm, is you go to a stereotypical industrial farm, there are no animals, there might be a backdoor garden, but the entire farm is a factory. Right? It's not about producing for the family, it's not about producing for the community, it's about making corn and soybeans so that we can do, corn oil and stuff in international markets. one of the things that will come out of good, sustainable agriculture, in my opinion, is local, communitarian, labor-intensive, highly biodiverse farming. And we've been doing it for a long time. This is important, too. In anthropological studies, one of the things that's really key is that there's a system of long-term intergenerational holding on the land so that people can invest knowing that they're not just doing it for themselves but for their progeny, right? It's not all about you. And they can do it without the tragedy of the commons. There are lots of systems where they have communal land held for certain resources, because it makes more sense to have large pieces of land for timber. That should be held in common. But if you break the common rules, justice is swift, right? Because you're not just taken away from yourself or from the forest, you're taken away from the community, and you're going to pay, right? And so Garrett Hardin's idea of tragedy of the common because of freeloading is not entirely true. We have safeguards. People have safeguards in place to see that freeloaders don't get away with it. Inequality of access is characteristic of smallholder agriculture, but it is not egregious inequality. Everybody gets to eat. In Tonga, where I went, there was lots of variation in wealth, but nobody went hungry. Right? So they can be shown to be sustainably productive, biologically regenerative, energy efficient, equity enhancing, and participate in relatively socially just. What does this have to do with Ohio? Same principles of sustainable agriculture, local food distribution system hold for temperate climates as well as tropical climates. I showed you tropical climates. The difference is we better learn also how to store food. But, you know, look, our grandparents did it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. Just get the temperature up so you don't get botulism. Everything's going to be all right. Local food systems, large variety of vegetables, meats. I buy all of my meats from a local farmer. I haven't bought an industrial meat in a long time, and I don't think I'm exceptional here. I buy as many vegetables as I can from local farmers. I haven't had a garden because I just moved to this new place, but when I've got my garden in, I can feed myself more or less from June until about October. If I have a lot of time on my hands, I can grow enough stuff to can a great proportion of my stuff as well. And I don't have a big garden. I think a lot of people can do that. And if your neighbor's helping you and he's growing tomatoes or she's growing tomatoes and you're growing peppers and you've got chickens and stuff like that, you can share your labor and share your resource to one another, build that kind of neighbor-to-neighbor kind of relationship, and then you only need a small amount of land, really. And you can do it in suburbia. You can do it in your backyard. Demand for local and organic food is increasing at a consistent rate of 20% a year, and every corporation in America knows that. If you're buying local organic food, it's also sustainably organic food. It's not confined animals being fed organic grain. That's not enough, right? It's got to be sustainable production. Know where you get your food. Basically cater to local producers. So I'm kind of wanting to end on a positive note. Humans have been doing agriculture for a long time, and disproportionately without petroleum. And so in principle, I believe that we can go, I won't say go back, we can continue the tradition of non-petroleum-based agriculture. You're going to get dirty. I had a student say to me one time, but I don't want to work in a garden. And my response to her was, you're not hungry enough. You know? My suspicion is that with peak oil, we will all get hungry enough if we haven't figured out how to do this. Thank you.
That was anthropologist and new agrarian Charlie Stevens speaking at the first national conference on peak oil and community solutions on the web at communitysolutions.org. Thanks for listening to Unwelcome Guests. You can contact us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.